Hi, and welcome to The Horn, a podcast from the International Crisis Group. This episode is in partnership with the Friedrich Ebert Foundation, or FES. Today, we have three guests who are here for a special episode on how Africa is responding to the string of coups and conflicts across the continent, and how the continent's peace and security architecture is holding up. On our panel, we have back with us Solomon Durso, who founded Amani Africa, as well as my crisis group colleague, Lizo Lauvaudrin, and last but not least, Paul Simon Handy from the Institute for Security Studies. Thank you, each of you, for joining us.
Good to be with you, Alan.
Good to be with you. Thank you.
It's a pleasure.
So, clearly, the African peace and security architecture, as it's often called, is under strain at the moment. We have the AU struggling to respond to the Sudan crisis, as we've discussed on this podcast quite a bit. We obviously have the string of coups across the continent that has everyone's attention. Perhaps another way to frame this discussion, too, this week is the UN General Assembly in New York. I think it's fair to say that in some ways, this is an end of an era for the UN in Africa. We aren't likely to see more of these big peacekeeping missions. And increasingly, it seems like the A3, the bloc of three African countries on the Security Council at any given time, is hesitant to endorse any major new UN lead in Africa. So I think it feels like in some ways we're in between eras, so to speak, but with big questions about exactly what comes next. I'm going to start with a broader question that each of you can tackle, and then we can narrow down this topic more to several of those specific crises. It's obviously been a busy year, and the year before that was a busy year. How would you all characterize the state of peace and security in Africa right now, and what are the cracks that have you most worried? And Solomon, I think we'll start with you.
Thank you, Alan. There are various dimensions to the current state of peace and security in Africa. I think overall, the picture is very grim. There have been quite a sharp rise in the number of conflicts on the continent, the geographic spread of conflicts. If you also consider other indices such as, for example, displacement or refugee flows or fatalities, all are indicating that we are in a very bad shape at the moment. These crises, you, in your introduction, made reference to take the form of constitutional and political crises involving military coups, which have make a comeback over the course of the past 3 years. While these obviously and understandably dominate the headlines and much of the attention, I think the most concerning aspect for me is the other aspects of violent conflicts. For example, the spread of conflicts involving terrorist groups, particularly in the Sahel, which became the epicenter of terrorism in the world over the course of the past several years. And indeed, we have witnessed on the continent widespread prevalence of conflicts involving terrorist groups, not just in the Sahel, but also threatening coastal countries of West Africa, the Central Africa region, and even Southern Africa on account of what's happening in Mozambique. The other dimension I think equally worrying is also the persistence of protracted conflicts in various parts of the continent, particularly here in the Horn of Africa, the Great Lakes region, as well as the Central Africa region. Added to that is also, of course, eruption of new conflicts. We have witnessed that here in the Horn of Africa with the eruption of the conflict in Ethiopia, a horrendous conflict, and most recently here in Sudan. So overall, I think we are in a very terrible shape.
I agree with Solomon. You know, we have seen an increase in displacement. In fact, the UN says there are now over 44 million people displaced through wars and conflict, but also through the effects of climate change. So, and these are compounding the lives of citizens that are displaced. You know, in many, many countries, people are suffering from these threats to peace and security. So We have in the Sahel, as Solomon mentioned, jihadist threats of terrorism. I can also add Somalia, of course, where there is still the threat of Al-Shabaab. And since 2020, we have 6 African countries suspended from the African Union due to coups. So it is really a big problem. And everyone at the African Union Commission and in regional economic communities, the regional blocs, are trying to see what is the best way to handle this.
Thanks, Liesl. And yeah, we will, of course, get to the coup question. Paul Simon, same question. How would you characterize the current state of peace and security in Africa? And what are the cracks that worry you the most?
I will agree with my colleagues on what is happening now. But if we take a long-term view and look at it from the historical perspective, then the picture is slightly different. Historically, state building has never been linear and peaceful. It's generally quite conflict-laden. So I like to see what is happening now from the perspective of the several transitions that Africa is going through, that African countries are going through. African countries are young, we should never forget that. And they have the teething ills of youth in terms of state building. So what we see are turbulences that are grave, particularly within the context of a booming demography. So they are problems, but I like to see them in the longer perspective. Problems that will be solved because decision makers in Africa have to deal with several transitions at the same time.
Thanks, Paul Simon, for stepping us back and reminding us of the broader historical context. I'm going to start narrowing down to several of these specific crises, if you will, and look at maybe what can be done about it at the moment. We've discussed the coups that have been going on. There is now this coup belt that stretches from the Atlantic Ocean all the way to the Red Sea across the entire Sahelian region. As Paul Simon mentioned there, for a while, you know, deterring coups was really known as one of the African Union's major strengths. And Liesl, I'll start with you. What happened to that strength?
The African Union, as you said, fairly consistently implemented the Lome Convention of 2000 that showed zero tolerance for coups. So the minute there was a coup d'etat, a country would be suspended from the African Union, and other international partners and institutions usually took the lead. We saw, for example, in 2017, there was what many had described as a coup in Zimbabwe. It was framed in such a way that it wasn't a coup specifically so that Zimbabwe would not be suspended from the African Union. So you could have argued at that time that the African Union's instruments were in a sense working. But we also knew that behind the scenes, the African Union wasn't doing enough about unconstitutional changes of government in other ways, and also not looking at really making sure elections are free and fair. So the other things that we know are some of the underlying causes of coups were not dealt with. But right, we had this instrument and it was fairly consistently applied. In 2021, when there was an unconstitutional change of government in Chad, the African Union did not sanction Chad, and many blame, you know, that move for the fact that the credibility of the African Union was undermined. Now it does seem as if one coup after the other, coup leaders are basically sort of ignoring the African Union. But it is also because I would say the underlying factors in that, you know, especially in the Sahel, and Crisis Group has written a lot about the fact that these are taking place in a very specific context of dire insecurity, threat of terrorism, jihadist threats in this region, major unhappiness with governance, and I must say also with the African Union and ECOWAS, institutions, and then the way that they are now responding in a sense are also, you know, people are also unhappy about some of the sanctions that are imposed and so on. So while that previous era of deterring coups worked in a sense, it's definitely no longer working because of the context and also because of the perception that the African Union is not being consistent in the way it is implementing and applying its instruments.
Within the continent, certain things have changed. Some of them are structural and have to do with demography, the level of income we have in Africa. I mean, many of those structural issues that make African states fragile. But on the political side, I think the biggest thing that has changed is the end of the consensus that was brought by the Lomé Declaration that Liesl just mentioned. We have the end of this consensus also because it is not a problem anymore for rulers to be seen as non-democratic. Autocracy has gained a new currency also because of some international examples, Russia, China, and some countries even like Turkey. And in that sense also, I think that some of the African leaders have contributed to this end of the consensus of Lomé because they've undermined the EU and ECOWAS frameworks. How are they undermined them? Actually, by abusing the consensus against coup. This consensus has been abused by president, incumbent presidents, namely because they turned this consensus against coup as if it was just the banning of military coup. That as if constitutional changes, for example, changes in constitution aimed to extend terms of ruling were considered as okay, but military coup were considered as banned. So this has really contributed to undermine the credibility of those frameworks by the same rulers who were actually supposed to uphold them.
Thanks, Paul Simon, and also for reminding us of the broader international context in which all of this is happening, of course. Solomon, what are the options for the African Union in the face of these string of coups, which, you know, has alarmed not just African leaders, but leaders around the world?
Yeah, I think a couple of points that I would like to add. The first one has to do with the fact that the anti-coup norm of the African Union, and I would add some of the regional organizations that have these norms, because not all regional organizations have the anti-coup norm. If you take, for example, that of IGAD, IGAD can welcome anybody, irrespective of how you come to power. The same thing in the Central African region. But for those that have these norms, part of the trouble has to do with the fact that enforcement of the anti-coup norm depends on external pressure or inducement. And that obviously clearly illustrates to you the existence of a weakness. That weakness has to do with popular support for the anti-coup norm within countries. The other thing has to do with also the response of the African Union and regional organizations, particularly since 2019. It started with Sudan. When the idea of zero tolerance to coups basically no longer held, because in 2019 in Sudan, the African Union accepted the fact that those who perpetrated the coup can actually preside over the transitional process that may culminate in restoration of constitutional order. Since then, we accommodated rather than basically removing and putting them back to the barracks. This incentivized other militaries to think that if they perpetrate a coup, they could be part and parcel of the transitional process. In terms of the options that the African Union and regional bodies have, I think we have to examine their role in two ways. One is the preventive dimension of their role. I think this is where we see the most serious weakness in terms of the role of the African Union and regional bodies like ECOWAS. They are not as proactive and active as you expect them to be in dealing with the various democratic deficits that Liesl and Paul made reference to. Whether it is in terms of ensuring that elections of questionable legitimacy are not endorse it, whether in terms of making sure that they send the necessary response when constitutional terms are extended without popular support and in conditions of fierce contestation on the part of opposition, the opposition and other sectors of society. And this failure to address democratic deficits and, I would add, the increasing lack of response or delivery on the socioeconomic expectations of the public have increasingly led to this breakdown of state-society relationship where governments have lost legitimacy and in the process the failure of the African Union and regional organs to do anything about these things obviously creates a legitimacy crisis for the AU and RECs because the AU and RECs try to step in after the fact. That is when the military coup happens. And of course, the other way of evaluating the response of the AU and RECs is what they do once the coup happens. And in this respect as well, we see various gaps with respect of which the AU and RECs can do better. I don't think that it is enough for the AU or RECs to slap sanctions or suspension of the country and then expect that everything would be okay thereafter. The expectation from the Lomé Declaration is that the suspension from the African Union, for example, is not meant to be really one that is meant to isolate the country. It is meant basically to express displeasure, diplomatic displeasure and censure on the part of the African Union, but immediately requiring the Lomé Declaration requires that the AU adopts a robust diplomatic response and engagement in order to fast track the speedy return of the country back to constitutional order. I don't think that we have seen the AU doing enough of this kind of robust diplomatic engagement that encourage the relevant reform processes that would put the country in a sustainable constitutional order, but also facilitate agreement on the return of constitutional order. The Peace and Security Council have been adopting decisions demanding that mechanisms dedicated to facilitating transition are instituted with respect to various countries, and there have been no follow-up and no deployment of those mechanisms by the African Union. And it is these gaps and weaknesses that understandably, of course, create the lack of regard or the declining effectiveness of the African Union and RECs responses to coups.
I think just applying the decisions of the Peace and Security Council will be a first step. Let's say now, for example, if you look at the two coups that we've seen in the last couple of weeks, really, in Niger and in Gabon. The Peace and Security Council, which are the 15 members, you know, that sit on the member states on the Peace and Security Council, have reacted, I think, very nuanced. And the two decisions on Niger and on Gabon are very different. The African Union and the Peace and Security Council actually took cognizance of the differences and the different contexts between these two coups because they are very different. For example, on Gabon, it asks for new fresh elections. Mind you, observed by the Peace and Security Department, Political Affairs Peace and Security Department of the African Union, which, you know, can step up to the plate and make sure that when it observes elections, it is frank about the problems with elections. And in Niger, you know, the African Union has been working for months now. We've heard about setting up a committee to look at sanctions in more detail, a subcommittee of the PSC. That is crucial because if we don't employ military force, which I think most people and colleagues at Crisis Group and others have written, you know, is really not desirable that ECOWAS deploys this military force for Niger. What are the other tools that the African Union can now deploy? Sanctions. Those sanctions need to be implemented, tracked, monitored, like the United Nations does with its sanctions committees. The African Union can do a lot of different things to implement its decisions and also to set up structures where that to make sure that there is this nuanced understanding and that the decision that is taken now can be implemented.
So I want us to turn next to the crisis in Sudan, which we can use as an example to zero in on one of these conflicts that the African Union and regional bodies now face and can struggle to deal with. So we've seen the African Union proclaim a lead on Sudan. We've seen IGAD proclaim that it wants to mediate the conflict. Neither of these initiatives has really gained much traction. And then you also have other initiatives from the African continent. And so before we talk about, you know, what can be done about it, first of all, Solomon, what exactly has gone wrong? And just to say to listeners, when our guests speak of RECs, so that's short for the regional economic communities or regional blocs, such as IGAD in the Horn of Africa and ECOWAS in West Africa. Solomon, over to you.
So I think peace and security diplomacy is in a state of crisis, not just here on the continent, but also one can say globally. We are in that moment of uncertainty globally with the fluidity of power relations of the world, but also the increase and fierce contestation between different centers of power. There are new entrants into the fray, middle powers, particularly when it comes to Sudan, the role of the Gulf countries, who are not known for pursuing and advancing multilateral-based, principled-based mediation processes. So in the case of Sudan, I think we have a number of things that we have seen going wrong, one of which is the proliferation of forums that seek to respond to the crisis, whether that is from the side of the US-Saudi with respect to ceasefire, the African Union's tent approach that you made reference to, Alan. Then IGAD also established a quartet. Neighboring countries are also providing a platform, whether it is Egypt, Chad, or Eritrea. So we have a lack of cohesive, common political strategy that is collectively owned and shared by different actors in order to have the level of impact that you expect with respect to the situation in Sudan. And if you look at Sudan becoming one of the largest humanitarian crises with nearly 7 million people displaced, that is a staggering figure that we are looking at. And if you go back to the 1990s, when the refugee and displacement crisis was at its peak, today the refugee and displacement crisis on the continent has taken over that peak by great margins. So even from that perspective of a long durée, today I think we are in a particularly difficult moment. I think it's important to underscore that point.
You know, I think that reacting to coups or having to do conflict management like in Sudan is always the symptom of a failure, because it's the failure of preventive diplomacy, as Solomon was mentioning. It's the failure of particularly preventive diplomacy. When we see how the AU treats its special envoys in certain countries, sending them with very little staff, very little capacity to actually undertake the political and diplomatic good offices, that is a failure. These are basics that I think we need to get right so as to avoid coming to the point where African countries and the AU have to go on an international tour to beg for money to fund its peacekeeping operations.
Paul Simon, a quick one before we turn to Liesl. Thank you for raising this issue of preventative diplomacy. We did see the African Union significantly under-resource its office in Sudan, for instance, in the run-up to this war. But just a follow-up question. Are you implying that sometimes the African Union and regional bodies should perhaps also be less militant, less territorial, if those are fair terms, of demanding the lead in conflict management?
Look, there's clearly a problem of capacity. Goodwill is there, but competition is almost inevitable between the AU and the RECs, the regional economic communities. And that brings African multilateralism and competition between those two levels, sometimes to a level that can be considered ridiculous in certain crises. I think the African Union has to polish its subsidiarity model and to see how much flexibility should get into it and how to really use the comparative advantages of each level. It's not easy. It can't be a one-size-fits-all model. But yes, I think that competition is there. It's not necessarily bad, but we should never forget that not all RECs have the same capacity and the same political will.
Yeah, I mean, this raises the question to me of whether there should be times for more receptiveness from Africa for the UN or someone else to step in with a leading role. Lisa, what should we be focusing on in terms of what can be improved?
I mean, we definitely are grappling with that in a situation where regional blocs and regional economic communities are launching peace missions and mediation missions fairly almost independently of the African Union. And some of them are neighbors, or I would almost say not knee-jerk reactions, but very military reactions to tracking their enemies in, you know, neighboring regions, for example. And we definitely need to fix it or work on it as we go forward. And as the African Union also needs to sort of assert itself, the United Nations, I think, Alan, I mean, as you said, beginning of this podcast, it's almost the end of an era now. We have MINUSMA that's leaving Mali. We have MONUSCO in the DRC that is winding down. The African Union is going to have to show that it has the capacity to use UN funding to lead African peace and security operations and activities, including mediation. So it will have to somehow better manage the relationship between the AU and RECs. And we really saw the situation in Sudan and the responses in Sudan suffering a kind of a stalemate because of this.
So Solomon, I want to go back to you and back to my original question of what exactly has gone wrong. There was expectations that the African Union might appoint a senior envoy or a series of senior envoys to really take the lead in Sudan. That was in May. And I think, you know, we saw this IGAD effort really kick up after it was apparent that the AU was not actually going to take that step. You are a very close African Union watcher. So I'm just wondering, why exactly has the African Union not stepped up in the way that many expected it to, perhaps not in the way the African Union itself promised?
In terms of the crisis that we are in, from an African perspective, I think we have to also look at and interrogate this whole mantra called African solutions to African problems, and its underlying premise, which has to do with the ideology of Pan-Africanism. I think we have a crisis with respect to these. I don't think that we have the level of conviction and dedication that helped the transformation of the OAU to the African Union and the effective take-off of the African Union peace and security mechanisms as well. I think we have a short supply of Pan-Africanism on the part of African leaders. The second element has to do with the leadership crisis. I think the leadership crisis both on the part of member states, but also on the part of continental and regional organizations. I think this needs to be taken seriously as well. And it speaks to the point that you made earlier on, Alan, that has to do with whether or not there could be circumstances in which the African Union or regional bodies can actually allow the space for the UN to take a lead. I think there should be every reason for that kind of process to happen. It's not really a question about who takes a lead. Otherwise, if we are going to make it a question about that, then there is a danger, a huge risk actually, that leads to exposing people who are caught up in the crossfire to be left to the dictates of the battlefield dynamics, as we have seen not just in Sudan, but also in other conflict situations as well. So the leadership issue, where, you know, some seem to feel that If they can't do it, nobody else should do it. I think this is the most irresponsible thing that we have come to see in recent years. With respect to whether or not there should be a dedicated special envoy or high-level panel of facilitators or a facilitator, absolutely, there should be. I think part of the initial response, if you look at the African Union was on a pole position. What we have is basically the chief of staff of the African Union Commission has taken a lead on the Sudan file, but the chief of staff of the African Union Commission, as you know, is responsible as the chief of staff for the functioning of the African Union Commission itself. He also has other files that he has to deal with, like Libya. But the nature of the situation in Sudan and the political environment in which this crisis is happening requires, obviously, such mechanism that works on a full-time basis on this Sudan file.
Liesl, do you have anything to add on this?
Maybe just to add to what Solomon was saying, Alan, many observers in Addis Ababa was also highlighting the fact that the African Union was, in a sense, sidelined or perceived that it was sidelined at the regional initial talks between the belligerents that was held in Jeddah, and that the comparison is made to what happened with the Ethiopia talks, the November 2022 Pretoria Agreement, where the partners who were funding some of the initiatives actually stepped back and sort of, you know, favored the African Union to lead with the negotiations to get that pushed through. And there is definitely a sense that if those direct negotiations or ceasefire negotiations start again, that the African Union and IGAD would like a seat at the table and be heard, so that we don't have a situation that we are seeing in Libya where, you know, a decade down the line, the African Union still really doesn't have a seat at the table and has really not been able to weigh in at all in any of the processes.
Thanks, Liesl. And yes, Crisis Group has called for AU and IGAD to be included in the Jeddah process. We've also called for the AU to appoint a senior envoy, or maybe the AU and IGAD to appoint a joint envoy on the Sudan crisis, which touches on something that Solomon and Liesl were saying. So we're running short of time. So I wanted to touch on just another aspect of all this, which is the evolving nature of peacekeeping, of multilateral military force, of intervention forces on the continent, however we want to phrase it. We don't need to talk about the specifics in terms of Mali or Democratic Republic of Congo, but, you know, it does very much look like the era of these big UN peacekeeping missions, you know, is coming to an end, as Crisis Group colleagues have written about. But you do, of course, have other interventions taking their place, although they're taking a variety of forms. So I'm just wondering if we're coming any closer to figuring out what a more coherent picture of peacekeeping and intervention forces might look like on the continent moving forward, or if the emerging picture is just one of incoherence, for better or worse. Paul Simon, I'm going to go over to you. I know you've done a lot of work on this topic. Where is peacekeeping, intervention forces, where is that heading on the continent?
I think peacekeeping is in crisis, and that's no indictment on peacekeeping. Peacekeeping is a tool that was actually crafted to respond to a very specific type of crisis. Yet the nature of insecurity in Africa is changing. It's also changing worldwide, actually. So this crisis of peacekeeping might be more visible in Africa, but it's an international one. So where we are headed to is a bit complex. A lot will depend on the goodwill of member states at the UN and at the AU. Peacekeeping is in crisis, but other forms of responses of conflict management are also in crisis. Maybe peacekeeping will have to go back to basics, to what it used to be, because the context is changing. What we're going to probably see is more a multiplication of these coalitions of willing, because another factor we haven't mentioned is actually that many countries hosting a peacekeeping operation today also feel the need to get additional muscles in the form of an additional bilateral engagement like Rwanda in the Central African Republic, or in the form of private military company like Wagner. So instead of actually bashing Wagner, I think we should ask the question, why does Wagner appear necessary to policymakers in those countries? Maybe it's because the peace support operation that is there is not sufficient, does not address what the government sees as the main threat, namely the persistence, and in some cases, even the multiplication of non-state armed groups, despite the presence of the peacekeeping operation. So it's a question of perception there. So we should ask the question, why do peace support operation, or, and particularly peacekeeping operation, do not appear to be sufficient in conflict areas where they are deployed? And why do states, the government, still feel the need of adding some muscles, sometimes, actually sometimes even making the solution worse than the problem it's supposed to solve? I think peacekeeping in the future will be more flexible, more ad hoc, will have a clear entry and exit strategy, will be more oriented towards coalitions of willing, and will just come to solve one specific issue and get out, because the long-term addressing the root causes of conflict view that the UN multidimensional operations were adopting will probably have to go down and be the job, not of peacekeeping operations, but rather of political offices of the UN. So more modesty probably will be necessary.
Liesl, what can be done to make this, you know, this evolution that Paul Simon's talking about, which we very much see in real time, what can be done to make that smoother?
I think, you know, what we saw in Cabo Delgado in Mozambique is a good example, because you had the Southern African Development Community deploying almost at the same time as Rwanda deployed in a very small area of Cabo Delgado. The African Union certainly could have helped with some coordination. It can, I think, still play a role in coordination, especially when we have all these overlapping initiatives like in the Eastern DRC and so on. But it will have to step up to the plate, you know, because over the short term, I think definitely lives are being lost. There are huge threats, and that we really would need African solutions. I mean, that's, I don't want to say that glibly, but it is definitely true.
Solomon, obviously 20, 30 years ago, when you talk peacekeeping in Africa, people would just look, you know, to the United Nations. Is it necessary to have greater coherence in perhaps this new emerging world for what framework and who leads these forces? Or is kind of this ad hoc coalition of the willing approach something that can work fine enough on its own?
Looking into the future or this particular moment, one of the things that we are witnessing is the proliferation of ad hoc, reactive, heavily militarized, and often you can also say national interest-driven responses. That is the kind of responses that we are witnessing. Some of them as an extension of national territories, basically. That is why, for example, in the Sahel or in the Lake Chad Basin, the troops operate within their territory, but with the possibility of crossing over into the member of the G5 Sahel or the MNJTF. So you have this national security extension dimension of it that you have. With that, obviously, comes the whole question of whether the principles, multilateral principles at that underpin peacekeeping can really be observed and upheld. I think that is the challenge. That is where, indeed, the African Union has a comparative advantage, because peace support operations are deployed as a collective response on the basis of multilateral principles that are similar to that of the UN's. And I think moving forward, what I would see in this current environment of politics and peace and security diplomacy is this, depending on how the AU takes leadership and acts, there is a possibility for the AU to create a space for deploying peace support operations on the basis of multilateral principles supported by the United Nations, including through UN Assist contributions. I think there is a lot of progress that has been made in that respect. There is a ministerial meeting that is happening at the end of this week in New York by the Peace and Security Council. And the African Stream members are taking lead in finalizing the draft of the UN Security Council resolution. And this is also, this development and positive, you know, progress has to do with the recognition of this particular moment, because we can't have a situation where the UN and UN's role wouldn't exist, because that would be an abdication of responsibility, given that the UN has primary responsibility for international peace and security. What you would end up having is a kind of a partnership of some kind would be designed either on the basis of, as the Secretary General's May 2023 report indicates, the joint mission model on the basis of UNAMID, or else the kind of EMISOM-ATMIS model with a plus that may involve additional provisions in order to enhance the effectiveness of such missions. But with the UN and the African Union undertaking joint and consultative decision-making, joint planning, joint assessment. So I think there is a possibility for that kind of model emerging. But this depends also, of course, on the African Union taking lead and demonstrating that it would able to be at the forefront of responding to these kinds of crises. Part of the reason why we have the proliferation of ad hoc responses, as well as the resort of African countries to anyone who is willing to provide security assistance, including the Wagner Group, has to do with the fact that the African Union, in some of these cases, is way behind the curve, and therefore they have to do with what they have, with ad hoc arrangements, as well as bringing in private military companies. So I think these are the kinds of situations that we need to be mindful of, and it's my view that the ad hoc coalitions, I don't think that they are the best that we can have. I don't think that we can consider them as a multilateral-based responses, a collective response mechanism in the way UN peacekeeping is.
Thank you, all three of you. You've taken our listeners on quite the tour de force, and in fact, we've probably been greedy in bringing up all these different topics with you. So obviously, the African Union is nothing but a collection of its member states. I think one of the themes of this general conversation has been that when we talk of a crisis of African peace and security, perhaps we should be talking about a crisis of peace and security in the world, including Africa. So I'll close up by asking each of you, if you could identify one piece, one realistic piece for member states themselves to focus on to perhaps shore up the African Union or the broader approach that the continent can take at this moment in history, what would you choose? Liesl, can we start with you?
In the months ahead, we are really going to look at choosing leadership for the African Union Commission for 2024. We also need a new chair of the African Union. You know, the African Union has now just become a member of the G20, so we'll need this high-level representation. And it's important for the continent as a collective to carefully consider these leadership roles, especially the chairperson of the commission and others. The new head of the commission will then step in early 2025, but that will be the debates in the coming months. So this leadership will be absolutely key. And then at the same time, while we need strong leadership and in line with what I said earlier about the relationship between the African Union and regional blocs, it would be good also sometimes for heads of state to take cognizance that sometimes they should step back in favor of the greater good, in favor of consensus and the most effective solutions collectively to stem crisis and to solve our problems.
Thanks, Liesl. Paul Simon, over to you for final words.
I will actually a bit follow up on what Liesl was saying and talk about leadership. Leadership at home, at national level, and leadership at regional and continental level. we really have a leadership crisis in Africa. And as you were saying, Alan, the EU and regional economic communities are just a collection of states. They're still very intergovernmental driven, despite the willingness to move them to a supranational level. These are intergovernmental organizations that are driven by member states. And sometimes you see a big competition between what the Commission wants to achieve at the EU and what member states are ready to let the Commission do. So in that sense, I think that we need a renewed leadership. But leadership does not necessarily mean being able to send soldiers everywhere. We also need a leadership of ideas, of how to improve preventive diplomacy, for example. We don't need soldiers for that. So this leadership, for me, is key. But leadership comes also with some level of exemplarity. Countries that whose government rig elections, countries whose government are not able to provide for the citizens, at least at small scale, do not have the legitimacy to lead beyond their own borders.
Thanks, Paul Simon. Solomon, over for you to close us out.
I don't want to sound dramatic, Alan, but my sense is that if we closely look at the street, how the street is speaking, whether it is through the coups that we are witnessing, whether it is through the refugee flows and the displacement and the migration, I feel that we are not in good shape. And as I said earlier, we are actually in a kind of a code red situation. And what that requires really is we can't continue in a business as usual fashion in how we deal with our current situation by looking at individual country situation or conflict situation or crisis. I think there is a need for having a very collective responsibility to be assumed by African Union member states. And it may require, for example, a kind of an extraordinary convening of the kind that happened, for example, in the early 1990s with the demise of the Cold War and the emergence new world situation. The Organization of African Unity, under the leadership of Salim Ahmed Salim, received a report by Salim about the state of the world and what that meant for Africa, and they adopted the 1990 Declaration on the changes happening in the world and their implications for Africa. That set the agenda for the 1990s, including some of the decisions that were taken, such as the establishment of, for example, for our area of work, the mechanism for conflict prevention, management and resolution under the 1993 Cairo Declaration. I think we need that kind of, I fully agree with Paul, rise to the occasion and assumption of leadership on the part of African member states that befits the gravity and pervasiveness of the crisis that we are facing, not just in terms of peace and security and democratic governance, but also in the economic and social realms, which underpins much of the other crisis. I think that is really what we need to do, and to do so with a sense of urgency and responsibility.
Thank you, Liesl, Paul Simon, and Solomon, for your time and your insights.
Thank you, Alan. Thank you.
It's a pleasure.
Thank you, Alan.
Thanks for listening. Once again, I'm Alan Boswell, and The Horn is a podcast of the International Crisis Group. This episode was once again produced in partnership with the Friedrich Ebert Foundation, or FES, produced by Mae Francis and Ida Holly-Nambi.